Good morning, America. This is Thursday, April 28, 2005. This is the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. And we're so grateful for all of you who are here today. As is our tradition, the first thing we want to do today is to recognize all those who have served our nation. And we're most grateful. Would you please stand? We are most grateful and forever mindful that we need to secure your future the way you have and continue to secure ours. And we certainly know that the freedom these young people over here have inherited was because of your service. And we do know that freedom isn't free, it wasn't free, and only because of individuals who are committed and dedicated to the cause of freedom, we preserve it. I'd like to recognize these fine young people here today. I'd like to ask Tessa Miller to stand, and Jessica Bryant, and Andrew Hunt. And let's welcome our youngest people. Thank you very much. And since they're all three very bright and capable and competent, someday they'll be sitting here or possibly where this admiral is sitting. And that's what we want you to do, continue this great tradition. Well, we're so honored today to have such a respected individual here. We're going to proceed with that testimony shortly, but first I need to ask if we could just take a moment in honor of a very highly respected individual. He's the state commander of our Department of Oregon Veterans of Foreign War. His name was Hal Jordan. Fought in the Korean War. He was in the Army. He just recently passed away, and his funeral is today. He and his wife, Annette, contributed greatly to our veterans and all their needs, and he certainly will be missed. He was very, very respected. Let's stand for a moment of silence. Thank you. Well, Dr. Stembridge, we're so fortunate today to have this very distinguished individual with us. Would you tell us about him?
This is Rear Admiral James Johnson. He's the original director of TRICARE West Region, and I've worked with Admiral Johnson's staff to arrange this. They've done an excellent job, and we're sure to have him here. Thank you.
Welcome, Admiral Johnson.
Thank you.
We really appreciate your coming all this way just for our veterans. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record, and I might have to remind everyone here today that we do charge for acronyms. Didn't you want me to tell him beforehand, said anything? We have a basket back here. It's our Veterans Fund. And in the case an individual doesn't remember if he uses an acronym, I do. And so $100 donations are certainly appreciated. I will now open this informational meeting on the health care benefits for our National Guard and the Reserve members of our armed forces and their families. Welcome.
Madam Chairman, I'd like to read a brief statement.
Please.
For the record. Good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I am Rear Admiral James A. Johnson, the Regional Director of the TRICARE West Region, which is based in San Diego. It's a pleasure for me to be with you this morning to provide a broad overview of the TRICARE program and how health care benefits are provided to service members, military retirees, and their families in the 21-state West region, which is about 50 to 60% of the landmass of the United States. More importantly today, I welcome the opportunity to explain the new TRICARE Reserve Select Benefit, which became effective yesterday. This expanded benefit is a tangible representation of the gratitude of the American people as enacted by the Congress for the expanded role of our National Guard and Reserve forces during the nation's global war on terrorism. The defense of our country is maintained by an all-volunteer force. And I might add, and as to the best of my knowledge, there has been no other entity in the history of mankind which has had a global military with a global reach that is all volunteer. It's comprised of three components: the full-time active duty service member, the part-time active National Guard and Reserve service member, and the civilian members of the Department of Defense. The National Guard and Reserve service members face a particular challenge as they are mobilized and perform the same mission as the full-time active duty component. Since 2001, Guard and Reserve members have spent months and even years in often arduous, life-threatening conditions separated from families and normal life. I applaud the wisdom of Congress for recognizing this change of mission for our National Guard and Reserve forces and increasing the benefit package for this deserving group of men and women. As the TRICARE Region Office West Director, I have the responsibility to facilitate the implementation of this expanded medical benefit package and to do so in such a way that these men and women and their families are provided the care they need while mobilized and to ensure that they have access to the high quality of medical care they deserve upon transitioning back to civilian life. This is a particular challenge since many of the reserves and National Guardsmen have faced significant emotional experiences in fulfilling our country's mission. There are a number of resources available to them, and it is our challenge to ensure that as transition occurs, they are well informed to navigate the myriad opportunities available to them. Congress has authorized a number of programs to assist in this endeavor. This issue has been of increasing interest to the committee as growing numbers of Oregon citizens take up arms in the Guard or Reserve as part of this vital national security mission. I join you in expressing our gratitude to these brave citizen soldiers and am pleased to describe the ongoing expansion and improvement of the TRICARE program as it serves the health care needs of these individuals and their families. The TRICARE program is extremely comprehensive, providing a robust medical benefit for the military members and their families, as well as retirees and their families. And it now provides a similar comprehensive medical benefit for our reservists and National Guardsmen. However, I do recognize both the beneficiaries and providers at times find the TRICARE program difficult to navigate. The reimbursement rates as determined by Congress are not always seen as favorable. Claim submission and timeliness are at times confusing. And access to providers who will accept TRICARE is limited in some geographic locations. I would enlist your help in increasing the number of providers in Oregon who will participate in the TRICARE program. Oregon's sons and daughters who have made significant sacrifices in defense of our country should not have to worry about finding a provider who will accept a TRICARE patient. I understand that the committee recently received a briefing on some details of the program from representatives of the Defense Department's healthcare contractor, TriWest Healthcare Alliance, our partner in the West. Accordingly, I intend to briefly add to the information you already received from them about the program and provide a description of the new TRICARE Reserve Select Program, after which I look forward to your questions on this program and how we can work together to ensure our service members receive the benefits they have earned. Thank you.
Thank you, Admiral Johnson. I'm so in awe, I don't even, I'm hesitant to speak today. I'm afraid I'll make a mistake while you're here, which is usual.
Madam Chairman, you can make no mistakes today.
Oh, good.
That's an order.
I like it. Thank you. Anxious to know how we can go about, increasing the number of participants in our state, and I'm sure that your staff can assist us in doing so, in knowing exactly, maybe why we're behind. And I don't know if other states are have as few as we do, or if something about being way up north, we're not connected properly or whatever.
Madam Chairman, TriWest has been very proactive in acquiring providers for the network. There are some pockets in Oregon that are underserved, as there are pockets in almost every state that are underserved. But since we started the new program almost a year ago, we've been very aggressive in getting more providers in the network. And more providers have signed up, even if they're not network providers. But there are pockets. In the brief that I prepared, I can show you geographically where some of those geographic challenges are in Oregon.
Oh, good.
Yes. Okay. I have a brief, and I'm not one for death by PowerPoint. So at any time. Anytime you want to stop me and ask questions, that's fine. In fact, I'll welcome the break.
All right. Well, let's proceed.
This is just an overview to show you the TRICARE region. We started the new contracts almost a year ago, last June. And the big difference is that we went from 12 regions in CONUS to 3. And the West region is very large in terms of its geography, which presents a unique challenge for us. We are the only region in which you have to go across 1,000 miles of ocean to get to a state, and we're the only region where you have to go through a foreign country to get to a state.
Oh, that's right.
Just review, the military health system provides care for our nation's families, for our active duty members, both Guard and Reserve, our retired members, and their family members. The TRICARE program on the contracting side is designed to make up for the services that cannot be provided in our military treatment facilities. In Oregon, this is particularly important since we have no military treatment facilities in the state of Oregon. The closest would be Madigan up in Tacoma. So access to care and claims processing, management of complicated cases, and customer services are all primary goals of the contractor. The program is composed of multiple parts, and the TRICARE Prime, you may have heard that, is like an HMO. TRICARE Extra is like a preferred provider organization. TRICARE Standard is more like your standard Blue Cross indemnity program. Mm-hmm. And we also have a program called TRICARE Prime Remote, and this is for our service members, recruiters, and folks like that who are in remote areas with respect to whether or not there are any bases or military treatment facilities. They will get their medical care in the community, but at a cost that is the same as if they were stationed right next to Madigan or Balboa or Travis. The contractor is tasked with optimizing the medical treatment facilities. We could have a much simpler system if we weren't trying to maintain our military treatment facilities, which are the backbone of providing health care for contingency operations. When our warriors go in harm's way, they take their medical assets with them. And when those medical assets are not with them in harm's way, they need to maintain their skills and proficiencies. And that is done in the military treatment facilities. At the same time, we provide a cost-effective, robust health benefit by doing this in our military treatment facility. So there are a lot of reasons why we want to have Travis's and Balboa's and Madigan's, but it makes it a little more complicated. But there's a good reason for that.
Admiral Johnson, now, how does this program mesh with the... here I go with an acronym, but the VA facilities.
Mm-hmm.
We have the White City here. We
yes.
have the Roseburg. We have Portland primary facilities. So how does this program in any way mesh with their services?
Madam Chairman, have you been stealing my script? This is a wonderful
good.
Segue. In the Western region, no more than half of our eligible 2.5 million beneficiaries live within access standards of a military treatment facility, meaning within a reasonable drive time to a Madigan, a Camp Pendleton, Fort Riley, Kansas, or whatever. The other half do not. When one looks at where VA hospitals and clinics are distributed throughout the West region, including Oregon, another 30-40% of our beneficiaries potentially come within access standards of care. So in the West in particular, we never look at how we can deliver care without taking into account the capability of the VA. It would be impossible for us to even get close to meeting our needs without taking into account the VA capability also. We have a number of initiatives, one of which will be starting in the next couple of months, that will focus on I-5 Oregon corridor with TriWest, the contractor, working with the VAs in Oregon, and how we can do some new creative ways of providing service. So, yes, we're very much interested in the VA. We consider them one of our major partners.
Thank you.
TriWest can give you the exact numbers, but I know for sure that we have more providers in Oregon today than we had a year ago. But do we have as many as we want? No, it's never enough, never too many. We, with such a vast region, when we were designing this, we knew early on that we could not do everything from an office in San Diego. TriWest knew they could not do everything from their corporate headquarters in Phoenix. And so we designed hubs and service centers all over the West, Oregon not being an exception. In Tacoma is where we have our major hub for this region to service Washington and Oregon, the Northwest hub in Tacoma. But we also have what we call TRICARE service centers run by our contractor in Astoria, North Bend, and Meadows Row and Lake Oswego. And for our reserve beneficiaries, we have a reserve beneficiary specialist who's located at Fort Lewis. So these are where you can go and talk face-to-face with human beings about the program. But in addition, particularly with the reserve benefit, if you go on the website for TriWest or any of the various websites, there's also ability to get information there, and also by calling 1-800-TriWest. So we try to provide multiple ways of getting the information out, including the media. Last night I had dinner with my old senior chief, who's retired in Bend, Oregon, and he brought me a copy of the bulletin, which as of yesterday, which has a very nice article about guard members getting new health benefits. And I've read the article, and it's quite accurate and informative in terms of the information it gets across. So there's essentially no means that we won't use to try to get the right word out.
Admiral Johnson, we have felt that in a number of our programs, especially those that the new benefits mm-hmm. that Congress gives us, that Department of Defense does not advertise, so for all the families to know what they're entitled to, it's very difficult. We have a wonderful Department of for veteran services here, and we have county officials, veterans officers, who are wonderful, but considering probably in a state with 370,000 veterans, it's about 1,400,000 family members that may need to know this. So we appreciate any type of advertising, you know, that can be done to let people know. And I think also the more advertising we do, speaking to the incredible benefits for the veterans, probably the more providers we'd get. I mean, if they realize that this is, you know, a value.
And how many counties are there in Oregon, roughly?
36.
So you have 36 county VA reps. We were just talking about this morning with the staff. You know, the personnel system sort of knows when people get mobilized in large numbers. It would seem to me, and they agree, we'll be looking into how can we take your 36 county representatives and give them information and updates in a systematic way, so that we work together, so they become our partners in getting the word out. As I said, this is another reason why I'm here, to not only provide information to you, but also to look for ways that we can partner with your assets so that our beneficiaries get what they need.
And would we be entitled to a portion of a PR budget or an advertising budget for the state of Oregon? Do you allocate funds?
I'm not the money guy.
Did we bring him or her?
Certainly, we have outreach programs, and between the contractor and my office and other elements, we try to get the word out. There is, in fact, a national contract within DOD for marketing and education. But it seems, you know, whenever someone says we have a budget, well, I don't know for sure, but I'll look into it. It just makes incredible sense to me that if you've got 36 people dedicated on a countywide basis for informing people about their veterans' benefits, and we've got 375,000 reservists and guard in the state, that, you know, irrespective of what the money people say, we ought to be getting together.
All right. So we like hearing that very much.
We'll figure out a way to work it out.
Thank you. That's been a worry of ours.
Well, you know, I'm not much of a defender of the bureaucracy. I just like the bennies to get what they need.
That's right.
This map shows, and really the big thing is the dark areas, dark blue area. These are what we call prime service areas, and by that we mean this is where we have large capability for people to be able to get service easily, and no surprise, you see it's basically centered along Interstate 5.
That's a pretty map.
It is. This is no surprise to you that there are a lot of providers along I-5 from, you know, Portland down to Medford, and with Eugene and Salem in between. We have an adequate number of providers who are credentialed, and that's important, and that we've negotiated reimbursement rates with them. And that's all in the Prime network. If a beneficiary goes to a Prime provider, someone who's in the network, then it's beneficial to both sides in terms of the out-of-pocket expenses that the beneficiary has to come up with. TRICARE certified providers are non-network providers who will still see TRICARE patients and reimbursement, usually under the TRICARE standard program. That's more choice for our beneficiaries, but also more out-of-pocket expenses. Pendleton and Klamath Falls areas are particularly challenging in terms of finding an adequate distribution and numbers of providers who will see our beneficiaries. And as you can see in this map, what this shows is a laydown of where the mobilized reserve and guard are concentrated in terms of where they come from. And there are significant numbers of mobilized guard and reserve in the Klamath Falls and Pendleton area, where we do not have as robust an array of providers as we would like. So again, as you move about in the state and in your districts, whenever you happen to see providers, I would encourage them to participate, at least as a non-network provider.
Yes, Colonel Representative Boquist.
Give the good Admiral a break from this, because you'll have a question. Admiral, maybe you don't know, or maybe the staff does. Is there any, do you have any definitive, I mean, Pendleton's a big chunk out there, and we have a United States Senator whose home of record is in Pendleton. And so I guess my question is, could you define to us, I mean, what is the challenge out there? Is it a reimbursement issue, or there just isn't a lot of doctors, or we haven't been able to convince them to come in, or as a member of your staff have an answer to that question?
In general, whenever you talk about people not wanting to sign up for the network, they see it as too many hassles, which can be defined as reimbursement. And our reimbursement rates, as I'll show later, are tied to Medicare. And not only because of that, and as you well know, Medicare is also becoming increasingly challenged in terms of whether or not people will accept a Medicare. When I talked to my senior chief last night, he's almost 80 years old, and he said, you know, he may have to look for other coverage or something because more and more doctors in the Bend area won't accept Medicare or TRICARE. And so that's a particular challenge for us. So reimbursement rate is an issue. Oftentimes we hear that timeliness of claims payment is an issue. It takes too long.
Yes.
That's an interesting problem. And at one time I practiced in San Diego. I'm a general surgeon by background. I practiced for 5 years in San Diego. So I'm very acquainted with the flow of cash in the private sector. But when we peel back the onion and talk to providers, oftentimes what we're dealing with is old information about a claim that wasn't paid 2 years ago or something like that. And when we analyze the speed of claims payment, oftentimes we find that it's not that bad. That our electronics claim payment, particularly under the new contract, is the goal is 2 weeks or less. We've gone and analyzed and find that we're turning around electronic claims in as little as 4 or 5 days. And so, again, there is that issue when you talk to providers that said, well, it's too slow. But when we go in and look, sometimes it isn't too slow. It's just their perception based on old data. But perception is truth. People will make decisions on perception. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. If they perceive that the reimbursement rate is too low, if they perceive that the payments are too slow, that's an issue. Now, Congress decides on the reimbursement way. I have no authority to alter that. Yeah. I can't. Congress decides on what the maximum rates are, and that's that. But we do work very hard with TriWest, our fiscal intermediary, to work on the timeliness. Because as a former private practitioner, I know that if you get me the money fast, I can afford to take a lower reimbursement rate. You know, it's nice to have a huge accounts receivable, but it's much nicer to have the money in the bank.
That's right.
And if you can turn my claim around in 2 weeks or less, then I don't need to have as much money in accounts receivable. I can afford to, you know, work less per claim if you turn it around that fast. So with WPS, well, Wisconsin, I've already, how much do I owe for that? WPS is,
you do, sir.
Wisconsin Physician Services in Madison, Wisconsin.
No, he's had a couple of others.
Oh, two others.
He owes.
We're going to have to get you a good rate.
Yes.
On your acronym fee.
WPS is Wisconsin Physician Services out of Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And they are our fiscal intermediary in the West, and they are also the fiscal intermediary that deals with TRICARE for Life. I personally visited their operations in Madison, Wisconsin on a number of occasions. They're a first-class organization of really hardworking people, you know, just terrific people, the same kind of folks you find in Oregon. And they're dedicated to getting the turnaround time for claims in under 2 weeks. So I think as that comes on board, that will help our providers to know that we're really working on their cash flow. But you know, who you see is a matter of choice. What I tell providers is, you know, I know the system may not be the highest pay, it may not be as fast, it may be a little more cumbersome. Congress sometimes writes things in somewhat of a complicated way. But, you know, our sons and daughters are volunteering. They're over in all kinds of places. They're in Iraq, Somalia, all sorts of folks. I don't want them to be the bill payers for the inadequacies of our system. That, you know, the benefit of the doubt, see our patients. You know, we'll work hard to get the money to you as fast as possible at the best rate that's available. But don't refuse to see our sons and daughters who volunteer to go in harm's way. That's the message that I would ask you to deliver to the providers in Oregon.
Vice Chair Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, no, I appreciate that comment, and I agree with you completely about it. I think it's also a fact that Medicare reimbursement rates are seriously inadequate, especially in places where we tend to have a shortage of medical practitioners anyway. Anything that you or your service can do to assist our congressman in working on the issue of differential Medicare rates would be useful for the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And it's possible, I hate to say this, but it's possible that you might want to try to differentiate your rates from Medicare rates in order to improve the issue that you're talking about. I think most of our physicians want very much to be involved in treating our military personnel. I also think that a number of them work in places where they have significant difficulties because such a large percentage of their clientele fall into the category of Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, and so I mean there's that other side of it. You get to this point after a while where the capacity to provide services just isn't there, and in some places in Oregon we are frighteningly close to that.
Yeah, I'm very understanding of that. When I was in private practice, I chose to serve an area where there were significant numbers of Medi-Cal, Medicaid patients, Medicare folks. I chose to do that. But it's tough on the providers. The Medicaid reimbursement rates, Medicare reimbursement rates are below their cost oftentimes. And their ability to do that sort of pro bono work is dependent on their ability to take on other kinds of reimbursement that, if you will, functionally subsidize the underfunding from various federal programs. But there are limits on that, too. And if you look in the private sector, the Blue Cross, Blue Shield programs, Aetna, all the other indemnity programs, they feel less and less compelled to provide a reimbursement rate that pays for the folks in their program but also subsidizes the other. So it is a huge problem, as you well know. We've got upwards of 45 million Americans who are underinsured or uninsured. It is a problem. Healthcare is, you know, what we're going to do with it is a national issue. And I know, you know, you and the legislature and the Congress are working on it, and we're all working on it. I'm just, while we're working on it, my focus is our beneficiaries. I know there are problems, but, you know, don't make those men and women and their families have to pay for it. They're paying enough with the sacrifice for doing what they're doing, and they volunteered to do it. They weren't drafted.
Our concern also in our state, Admiral, is that to access our Veterans Hospital, you know, from Medford, mm-hmm. for example, is a long drive. And, you know, we have, as a matter of fact, passed a memorial from the House that allows veterans to access local medical care. There were two negative votes, which surprised me in the House. The reason being, they felt that we were taking business away from, you know, the Veterans Hospital, but we're not. And then just on Tuesday, I read a letter from a disabled veteran who explained for dental care, for example, the Veterans Hospital can only accept 300. I mean, the capacity is not there. At the same time, we have no other facilities that they can go to, and you know, a root canal doesn't wait. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, to me, it's always it seems disrespectful for us not to allow them in an emergency to, you know, to not allow them to access local medical care for an abscess. Access for an abscess. That's what I should name that program. So I guess what I'm asking, when I look at this program, and I would not be in the military, I don't fully understand the process, but, you know, it says retired service members serve the country more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. Concerns me. We have just recently adopted a new definition of veteran. Because we felt that, you know, any individual, you know, who has served in our military services is, you know, and retires has been a veteran. I mean, has earned that right to be called a veteran, should have the capacity to or capability to access any care. So this says retired service members who served the country more than 20 years. And I'm just wondering, under this plan, then... this covers everyone, so if this is the case, those people from Medford should not have to drive all the way to the VA hospital. They should be covered.
The way Congress has chosen to execute the program makes a distinction between care that's provided by the Department of Defense and care that's provided by the Department of Veterans Administration. So there are two federal agencies, both of whom have the ability to provide care. Both the Department of Defense and the VA, the Veterans Administration, have hospitals, have clinics. What Congress has determined the eligibility or how you direct people to which of the facilities to go to. For Department of Defense, our eligible beneficiaries are either the members who are on active duty and their family members, or members who have retired from active duty, and that's defined in general as someone who served 20 years or more. That's our population. The Veterans Administration, for let's say a service member who serves 2, 3, 4 years and then leaves and is now back in the community, a veteran, the Congress says that individual seeks their care through the Veterans Administration, and has published a number of things that how you determine eligible care. So that's the definition. But they're both federal agencies, and then there are ways to work collaboratively, and they have different, you know, funding streams, and there's all that sort of stuff. But there are ways to work collaboratively so that we can work in partnership to look at both populations.
If I could give you an example, mm-hmm. of a veteran. I was at a recent meeting. He was over in Pendleton, had a heart attack, had to have heart surgery, of course couldn't get to the VA hospital. I can't remember, $16,000 or $19,000 they had to pay themselves, because then it was our understanding this was not a military-caused injury.
Service-connected disability, right?
Yeah. So it wouldn't have mattered, I guess. I mean, he'd have that because he didn't have secondary insurance.
What Congress has done for the VA is, for you to be eligible for the VA, you have to have served, but also have a medical condition that is at least related to the time that you served. Those are the rules that Congress has put out, actually law. In Department of Defense, you may not have that, but Congress has set up a different set of rules for the active duty and for those who have served the nation long enough to qualify for retirement, which is, say, 20 years. And if you will, there is a more liberal access for DOD beneficiaries, which Congress has seen fit to make it that way because they are active duty or have retired.
Well, what do we do? Because I'm worried about these individuals who've spent 10 years, you know, and they just find out that they're not going to be able to fund a college mm-hmm. education as much as they love their country and their service component, but, you know, finally decide, I've got to start my own business.
Sure.
I'm going to put four kids through college. So why can't this program provide additional coverage for those? Do you see what I'm saying? From those that are active to those that retire, that gap.
Gap, yes.
Gap insurance we need.
That would be something that Congress would have to take on as a something they want to do. The reason why we can't do it is because Congress hasn't authorized a program like that.
Okay. I think that's something we could work on. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions at this point? Okay. Sorry. Please proceed. Okay.
We were talking about reimbursement, and CMAC was a very popular acronym, which stands for the Champus Maximal Allowable Charge, which is the most you can get reimbursed for a particular procedure or service under CHAMPUS. And the keys to that is that CMAC rates are congressionally mandated. It's not something that, in my capacity as a regional director, I determine what the rates are. Congress determines the rates. And as I said earlier, they're tied to Medicare rates. They're provider-specific payments in terms of the procedures and whatnot. There are some differentials depending on locale and regions of the country. They're very much driven toward the type of procedure, and so they can be very complex. If you don't code things correctly, your reimbursement rate goes down. In fact, there are now 4-year degrees on how to do medical coding. Oh yes, it absolutely determines the revenue stream in any provider's office. Ultimately, you're talking about computers moving the money, and while they're very fast, they're not very smart. They can only add up zeros and ones very fast. Is what they do. So it's all about taking what we would say an appendectomy or a cardiology consult and translating that into language that a computer understands, so the computer will move the money. And it's very complex. There are thousands and thousands of codes, and it's very complex. And if you don't code it right, or your coding isn't matched up with the latest array of codes that the government has put out or the private sector, you don't get reimbursed. Which is very frustrating. That can be another one of the issues that comes up with our providers who say, well, things are too complicated. Some of the issues relate to whether or not you're coding things properly so that the TRICARE system will understand your claim and the computer will move the money for you. Mental health. I know mental health gets to be an issue about whether or not there's parity. As I said, I'm a general surgeon. I'm not a mental health provider. However, fundamentally, the way I look at it is there are certain rules and processes that apply. For example, for TRICARE, the first thing is whether or not it's a covered benefit as defined by Congress. The process for determining whether or not it's a covered benefit should be the same for mental health issues as medical surgical issues, in my opinion. Is it medically necessary? Again, there are procedures for determining whether or not it's medically necessary. Those processes should be the same for mental health codes as they are for medical surgical codes. In actuality, for our program, compared to a civilian program, I believe I can truthfully say we have as much or more parity than any civilian program with respect to mental health. We have more flexibility. Our TRICARE Prime members who are in essence an HMO-like program can self-refer up to 8 times per year without requiring any additional authorization to see a mental health provider. I'm not aware of many, if any, civilian programs that offer that benefit. We have a robust benefit for substance use disorder, which is very important for our families, particularly with their adolescent and preteens who get into those kinds of issues. We offer residential treatment for up to age 19. There are many programs that don't offer that at all. So, you know, I think overall in our program, we've done a very good job at moving toward parity and offering a comprehensive mental health benefit.
That's good.
A little bit about sort of the continuum of care, and this is a graphic. The TRICARE Prime benefit, which is the one that has the least amount of out-of-pocket expenses for a member. Any reserve or guard member mobilizes, they are essentially in that program, the service member. Then the things happen, you know, when it's time to demob, what happens? What if they have an ongoing medical problem that's not resolved or even figured out how it's going to be resolved? They've had a significant injury. You know, we've got a lot of folks with our body armor, and I did worked on some of the research with that in some of my previous positions. But the body armor, which has been so effective in increasing our survival rates, selects out for injuries. It diminishes the chances of getting a major torso injury, which is the ones that are most difficult to survive. So we have a lot more service members surviving, but they're surviving with a lot more extremity injuries and head and neck injuries. And these injuries, while survivable, oftentimes lead to very long rehabilitation issues. I personally believe that we have not yet begun to scratch the surface on the magnitude of our mental health issues with respect to the global war on terrorism and deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. That tsunami has not hit yet,
right,
but it is coming. And particularly with reserve and guard, where their families have remained at home, often not close to a military treatment facility. Whatever those issues are going to be will affect families. And so I think we're going to have to, and people are looking at how we're going to do this, because nobody has the complete answer yet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Admiral Johnston, I really appreciate your saying that. Our anecdotal information that we're starting to get absolutely agrees with that. And that's a real concern to us.
It's a great concern to me, and I'm just a surgeon. So if I can figure it out, I said, you know, it ought to be pretty obvious to everybody. But, yeah, we are going to have to work on this. And even more so than some med-surg issues, it will require Department of Defense to work collaboratively with the VA. Mental health is post-traumatic is one of the core competencies of the Veterans Administration medical care. If they've got a lot of expertise in that, and working with the private sector, and it's my job to smooth out the bumps that allows us to bring those entities together. If a service member has a medical issue that has not been resolved sufficiently, they can be put on medical hold, and for the problems to be worked out more effectively. That can be good and that can be bad. On the one hand, they haven't been released yet. On the other hand, they haven't been released yet. I mean, there's pluses and minuses to being in med hold. And I think particularly for our guard and reserve members who have families, med hold is not an attractive place to be. They would like to be back home with their families, having their issues addressed. But again, one of the problems is getting their issues defined well enough before they leave active duty under Title 10, before they and go into another status. So that's why the med hold. Congress has seen fit that once you're released from active duty, the TRICARE benefit continues for 180 days. It continues. The TRICARE Reserve Select Program is the program the Congress has put into place to deal with what happens after that 180-day period. Particularly with a lot of our Guard and Reserve, yes, there are laws that says that, you know, your job has to be held and all that sort of stuff. We all know that that's imperfectly executed. Even if you do have a come back to a job, you may not come back to health coverage, depending on how that is set up with your employer. And Congress has recognized this, and this is what the Reserve Select Program is about, that just started yesterday.
Great. That's good.
And this pretty much goes over the things of talk. One of the things that is difficult for us is the middle bullet. It talks about early eligibility, and this is where you get an activation order to mobilize. Up to 90 days before you actually mobilize, you become eligible for TRICARE. The problem is the way the personnel system currently functions, folks may not actually find that out till a couple of 3 weeks before they mobilize. So the ability to take advantage of this benefit, the early, is very much dependent on how efficient the personnel system is in determining your eligibility.
Our 3670th left before we were even able to notify them that this was in effect.
This is a particular personal sore point for me.
A DOD, it was late, apparent, late announcement by DOD that they were being called.
Right. To be honest with you, Madam Chairman, there is not unusual to have late public announcements. But usually if a unit is going someplace, the decision wasn't made a couple of weeks ago. There is planning. And I think with more cooperation and more exchange of information, we can get early warning, the early warning that we need. While the order might not come to someone until 2 weeks before they leave, the fact that someone was thinking about sending them or someone like them is known way before 2 weeks. We just need to do a better job of agreeing to share information so that things like this can be put into the planning phase. When we've done this, I've seen time and time again that we can be very effective in providing the services people need, even if we have short notification, as long as we can make plans and put contingencies and activate things. I'll give you an example. When I was a commander at San Diego, I knew, for example, based on the operation plans of the Marine Corps Camp Pendleton, what sorts of things the Marines would have to do. Okay, not rocket scientists. The 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, their primary mission is to Central Command. That's the Middle East. Don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out if things are heating up in the Middle East. Chances are pretty good that the president, whomever that is, will call upon the Marines to go over there. So knowing that, I knew well in advance, depending on the number of Marines that would go, what sort of assets would leave my medical center to go with them, particularly in the emergency department. I knew that those folks would leave on short notice because that's what the op plans call for, deploy in less than a week. And I could lose 50-60% of my emergency room staff in less than a week. So we sat down with the contractor and we developed contingency plans. What if an order like that comes? Where would I get emergency room personnel, because it's too short a notice to even activate the reserves back up? And so we worked out a wargaming plan, and we worked out contingencies with the contractor. And when that order actually came, we had a plan we could pull off the shelf, and I had replacements from the civilian sector within 96 hours after my people left.
All right.
Even though the notification I got was only a very short notification. So, again, if we get the right people to share the information when the plans are being formulated, then we can come up with the right kind of execution so our beneficiaries aren't caught up short. So I would enlist your help as you're talking to the congressional folks and, you know, all the various stakeholders to be proactive about sharing information early. I think I've said enough about this one. It's nice but very difficult to execute. The Transitional Assistant Management Program, the TAMP program, another one of those acronyms, is a good program. It provides 180 days of health coverage beyond the time in which you are demobilized. You must enroll if you wish to be in the prime program, but that's not an additional burden for the reserve or guard. That is what everyone has to do who's going to be in prime. It's an active enrollment process. For the other programs, TRICARE Extra, TRICARE Standard, there's not an active enrollment process. One key there is eligibility. Eligibility isn't something the medics determine. The personnel side of the house determines eligibility. I can't provide service to anybody if they're not eligible. And I'm not the one who determines the eligibility. So that can be a sticking point sometimes. This is a new program which just started up, and Congress said beyond the TAMP program, we recognize that we've really changed how our Guard and Reserve are functioning. It's no longer are they coming on board for a drill weekend, a couple weeks in the summertime. We're asking our Guard and Reserve to do the same missions as the active component. They're driving the trucks, they're doing the special ops, they're flying the airplanes, they're sailing the ships, they're doing everything the active component is. The difference is they're not doing it full time. And it's put an enormous burden on execution of the law that protects their employment. But what do you do if you're self-employed? A lot of our Guard and Reserve are self-employed. What happens to their program? So Congress has seen fit to put this TRICARE Reserve Select Benefit in. It provides 1 year of standard coverage for every 90 days you serve in a contingency in Title 10, meaning you've been mobilized for military service. For each year that of coverage you're given, you must obligate to stay in the Select Reserve. So Congress put that benefit in there, but the benefit comes with you're willing to continue to be in the reserve. And again, the last bullet, eligibility, isn't determined by the medical side of the house. It's determined by the members' unit. So there's a lot of education and training that has to go on the personnel side for making sure the members understand their options before they're demobilized and go off active duty, because they have to decide about whether or not they're going to be in this program before they go off active duty. There are costs associated with it, and I won't go over the specific costs. You can look at them. I will tell you that compared to any major program they could sign up for on the outside, this is a good deal. It's more comparable to the federal employees health benefit program, but it's better than that. So it's not free, but when they're receiving this benefit, they're in a demobilized status in the reserve, Select Reserve, going back, in their communities, and being offered a health care coverage that is considerably better than what they could purchase on the open market.
Yes, Representative Boquist.
Admiral, I know you're the executor here, but let me walk back the rationale of this here.
Because
Congress is the one who ultimately decided this. You have a soldier who is coming off of, is in the demo process, which could be anywhere from seven. It could be the ideal window that the Secretary of Defense put out, which is a 21-day process, or in the case that we've seen here in the state, we're going to be less than 7 days. In that seven-day window, the soldier, sailor, or marine reservist who already knows they're going to have 180 days of automatic coverage, who does not know whether their job's really going to be there, who does not know whether their health insurance is really going to be there, has to make the decision 6 months before his coverage ends on whether he wants to buy insurance 6 months from now is there an alternative or another mechanism? I think my point is well made.
It is well made.
And I know you're the executor, Admiral. And so, I mean, what was the rationale, and is there an exception to this policy at some point?
Again, Congress's rationale was to tie this benefit to continued service in the reserve. We're just beginning to execute the program. On the service side, they have to determine eligibility, and there has to be an intent on the part of the service member. I believe we are interpreting intent fairly liberally, that if you have shown an intention to sign up, that will suffice during that 180-day period. Not actually signing on the dotted line, but with an intent to sign and then being able to execute it over that 180-day period. But we have to work, again, closely with the service side of the house, the reserve component side of the house, the personnel side of the house, to make sure that we're all on the same sheet of music. I agree with you. You know, someone who's coming off of a year in Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia or whatever, they hit the gate at Fort Lewis. They've got 7 days to get back to Klamath Falls. There's all kinds of things swirling around. It's an intense pressure that the active component doesn't have because they're not going home the same way. So there's more time to sort out some of these issues. I believe the members of Congress' intention was to make this benefit available. And sometimes when you get into the execution, the members of Congress don't necessarily see some of the pitfalls of execution. It looks good on paper, and in execution it's a little more problematic. I think as these things unfold, the members of Congress are very interested in seeing that the Reserve and Guard members who are mobilized into Title X have more rather than less parity with respect to the active component. And if there are barriers to execution, I'm confident that the members of Congress will work with us to smooth out those barriers.
We, you know, in this committee have determined that the state needs to provide access to medical insurance for those individuals that are in the gap.
Mm-hmm.
Because we never know we're going to have a forest fire. And I mean, these men and women, you know, their jobs are always precarious. And then not to have insurance is really precarious.
It's a very tough situation. As I said, we've got 45 million Americans who are underinsured or uninsured. The grocery strike in Southern California that lasted 5 months was entirely about health coverage. Entirely.
Mm-hmm.
It was about what coverage is going to remain for people who've been working and what coverage people who are a new entry into grocery stores are going to get. Entirely about health coverage. There were no other issues. So it's a major issue, and you know, I can't fix everything. I can only fix the piece that's been handed to me. I think we should do things to make it easier rather than harder for our beneficiaries to get what they need.
That's right. Representing that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One piece I'm wondering if you do have the statutory authority to fix. I notice you have a differential on the previous slide in the cost share. There was a differential between using a network provider and a non-network provider, which makes great sense if you're living a mile from a network provider and you choose to go off the network, you should have to pay more. But based on your previous maps, in areas where there is no network provider anywhere close by, I guess it seems unfairly punitive to me to have to pay that additional 5% of the cost in order to go off the network when there's really... and there is no network available. Is equalizing that within your authority, or is that a congressional mandate as well?
Congressional mandate. The TRICARE Prime Remote Program, Congress determines who's eligible for that. Where you are, for example, if you're a recruiter in Pendleton, than an active duty recruiter, then you can be in TRICARE Prime Remote, which means when you go out in the commercial sector, you don't pay standard rates. You pay the same out-of-pocket expense as if you enrolled in TRICARE Prime program at the MTF. But Congress has to determine who's eligible for that.
I believe I'm going to go through the steps here, but I'm just... The key factor here of being eligible at some point appears to be step one. And can you give us a little idea of how to ensure soldiers are in step one? I'm assuming that it looks like you sign up via the internet and you fill out the form and then you're registered and then there's a service agreement way down the line. And it would seem to me that if virtually every soldier, reserve soldier, leaving service signed up, they would at least cover their eligibility intent at some point in the future.
Again, I think this is how we're looking at it when I say liberal interpretation. This is only the second day we've been doing this. And we didn't get a whole lot of lead time from when Congress passed the law.
Admirable that you got this far.
Come on, Admiral. What, second day, we were 100 miles inside Iraq. So.
Right. Yeah, but doing that's easier. We only had to battle Saddam Hussein, not the federal bureaucracy.
Well taken.
Anyway, those are the steps. It's a three-step process. This just outlines how the coverage begins, and I agree with you. As we execute this, I mean, this all seems very logical, but... Again, you're dealing with, you know, a 31-year-old father of two, mother of two, just come back from an extraordinary experience. They're trying to get their life back in order, and all this stuff is being dumped on them over a relatively short period of time. It doesn't all get through in terms of, you know, what they hear, what they're listening to, and, you know, I think we got to be reasonable and rational about it wherever possible. Again, I'm always focused on the bennies, and sometimes even I get smacked for doing that. Again, these are some of the areas where our outreach program, where you can get more information. And I'll just leave that up there, and if you have any other questions, I'll be happy to entertain them.
Well, Admiral Johnson, we're just so grateful for you to come today, and we thank you for this information and for all you do on behalf of all of our military and our veterans.
Well, Madam Chairman, I want to thank you all for inviting me and for your proactiveness and working in this state. It is much appreciated. I believe it's a partnership that we need to expand and work on more and more. You know, our beneficiaries, our sons and daughters, husbands and wives, I mean, I know there are all these necessary separations because of funding streams and appropriations and constitutional this and that. But, you know, and I'm not against it. I swore to uphold and defend the Constitution and all that. But, you know, when you're just, you know, when you're a 22-year-old out there and you've just come back, that's not how you see the world. You see the world as... you need certain services, and how much am I going to have to pull out of my pocket, and where am I going to get things? And you know, you don't care whether it's state mandated or locally mandated or federally mandated. It's a buck is a buck. It looks the same to you. And I know we have to pass legislation in ways that respect all of those separations. But when it comes to execution, we need to focus on our beneficiaries and get them what they need.
Absolutely. I just had an important question.
Yes.
Admiral, since we're on day two, and 8 days ago or 10 days ago, the second of the 162nd got demobilized, what happens to everybody under this law? What happens to everybody before 3 days ago?
There is... in the legislation, a clause for dealing with the historical group, and I didn't put that in there because it's pretty complicated, but there is a provision for trying to go back and figure out the folks who are eligible for the program but weren't on active duty as of now. So the folks who are eligible for the program going back 3 or 4 months ago who now demobilized, they're back home, in Bend, Klamath Falls, Portland, wherever, and now this program's come online. Again, I'm looking for any means possible. Media like this, the newspaper, the 36 county representatives, I think we have to engage everybody who touches a potential eligible beneficiary and get the word out.
How historical is that retroactive?
It goes all the way back to 9/11. We have sent out information to 377,000 historical folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I'd say for the record, because I believe Colonel Caldwell is sitting back there in the back, is we need to get on the bandwagon quick here.
Yes, we do.
Right, I think the Colonel's listening. We got a nod.
Yeah. Thank you, Admiral.
Any other questions?
I guess not, and thank you once again. And it's not customary, but we would like to just applaud you for being here today.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm going to call an end to our informational meeting, and we'll stand at ease for a few minutes. Committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Oh, yes. No, we, no. Express our love for that family.
I certainly will. Yes, ma'am.
We will now open public testimony in a work session on House Bill 2737.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2737, you heard on the 22nd of March, it is similar in a way to House Bill 2602. It creates a program for family relief for active military families. This bill has a subsequent referral to revenue. The bill you passed out had a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and that's where it is. We put this on the agenda for your consideration because of the differences in the process. This House Bill 2737 does not have an appropriation, but does go to revenue because it is involved with the charitable checkoff program. You have an amendment that I believe comes from Representative Barnhart, which limits beneficiaries to residents of Oregon. It authorizes.
I don't have that for some reason.
Okay.
Do you have one, Scott? You didn't.
I have some extras.
Oh, sorry. Here,
I believe.
It's a dash one.
Yeah.
Dash one.
Mm-hmm.
Here you go.
Thanks. One.
Got it.
Do we have some out also?
Okay, could you let us know, Representative Barnhart, what does this amendment do?
Madam Chair, this amendment is an attempt to deal with the conversation that we had at the time of the public hearing, and I hope that it includes all of the issues that you brought up and others brought up at the time.
Okay.
For example, it changes the eligibility rule, which is in lines 7 through 13, to what's in lines 3 through 6 of the proposed amendment. It changes grants to grants or loans in several places. It changes rule by to regulation of in line 16 to deal with Colonel Caldwell's problem about the way we describe rules.
Right, regulations.
Made in by the military department. They call them regulations instead of rules. Then there's a definition of child, which is to be inserted after line 19. All of those issues came up in the discussion of the bill
during the public hearing. And Jim is right. This bill is very similar to the one that we sent off to Ways and Means. The difference is that this one sets up, let me see if I got it right, this one sets up the checkoff but does not have an appropriation. It occurs to me that, I mean, I assumed that one of the reasons why this got scheduled after we passed the other one is that it gives us one more vehicle to get this idea over to the Senate in the event that the Ways and Means process doesn't get that one through.
Yes, it does. Line 17, I hate to tell you, should say, shall write regulations. This has us adopting them before we've written them.
Line 17?
Mm-hmm.
Line 17.
It should say the department shall write regulations.
The department shall adopt regulations.
Not adopt, because they haven't been written yet.
Well, I think adopt includes write.
I do too.
Doesn't it, Jim?
I believe
Colonel Caldwell, come forth, please.
Yes, Colonel Caldwell, come forward.
Yeah. I don't think we want to get this going. We're right around it now.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of Military Department. This has been kind of a, I think it's a word of art, depends on the lawyer who particularly writes it. We used to have language that was fairly consistent that said promulgate regulations.
Good word.
And for some reason, lawyers didn't like that word, and they've gone to...
And we're back to one syllable.
Two.
Yeah, so I think...
Right. No, mine is... What? You're a doctor, so yours is two syllable, and mine's... I've just got a master's, so mine's one.
Right.
So right. For whatever reason, I think the legislative council decided that this was clear. It certainly means to us that we would create the regulation.
Right.
If it's a physical writing, of course, that would happen, but it's a creation. It's a, you know, so we interpret it that way.
Madam Chair, I might just say that I think the word adopt implies some sort of official action, whereas
correct.
Write may not in some people's minds.
Thank you. And line 8, let's see. I'm on the right line. In the original, let's see, where am I? Oh, line 7, sorry. If you go to line 7, you took care of that. For whom, you know, this benefits, the member of the immediate family is changed to a member of the Oregon National Guard or a member of the reserves of the Armed Forces of the United States who is a resident of Oregon. Now, should that say whose home of record is Oregon, Representative Oakley?
I'm looking to see. No, yeah. Ma'am, because there's no comma.
But I mean, do they have to be a resident?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's resident and home of record. Legal counsel believes resident covers home of record, and there's
it
an
does.
Entire
okay.
statute
one to be
this
sure.
long that covers all this stuff.
Okay.
This is the
mm-hmm.
same argument I think
because
we had.
Because if somebody temporarily is living in Redding, California, because
right.
they had to, I want it to cover them.
Right.
They're temporary there.
But a person living in Redding might still be a resident of Oregon.
That's what I didn't want to... If they're paying, they could be paying taxes in both places. And then, okay, so who's resident of Oregon or the spouse or child of a person described in paragraph A. And I thought we said dependent or designee of a state because we have individuals who have dependents. They're not their children. But they're legal guardians of dependents. So that's the one thing that I'm concerned about. And I know this is a real fact. Representative Bocal.
Madam Chair, I'll question Colonel Caldwell. I believe if they're a legal dependent, they would be entered into the, I have no clue what this stands for, into the DEERS program, which would be your determination under your present regulations, is it not?
Madam Chair, Representative Bokus, that's correct. The any legal dependent child, in some cases it could even be an elderly parent that would be underneath that program if there's a legal sanction to allow that family to have that designation. So, again, I think we would look at it very broadly in the respect of the any dependents and or children of that particular individual.
Okay, so Representative
Bokus, just to follow up, just say what we're saying is under the military DEERS program, right, language, legal language, child is any dependent that is certified.
Okay, but we do not do that, and you'll see that we go down see line 13, it goes even further. Used in this section, child means a person who is a natural child, adopted child, or stepchild of a person described in subsection 1. I hope we just say dependent, because when we get, you know, I have every kind of children there are, and we could put good and bad in there. But could we just say dependent and then leave that the child issue out? A legal dependent?
Madam Chair, I think if I was going to do that, I think I would add something to the effect that any legal dependent so noted by the military service. And then you basically have deferred that to anybody, as Representative Bokus indicated, that is currently recognized as the serviceman's dependent, age, shape, form, doesn't matter.
Well, the easy way to do that would be to add a D to this sub 4 that says that. Other dependent.
Correct. And then you cover the waterfront.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. Would you mind to do that?
That's no problem.
Because I know this is an issue just with the number of veterans that in military this is very important.
I know it is. Yeah.
Okay. If that's all right. Any other discussion? Okay. If not, I'll.
Madam Chair, I might just add one other point.
Yeah.
And if we're going to do another amendment, I think it would probably be well,
good,
as we talk about in line 3, where we talk about a member of the Oregon National Guard as a member of the Reserve of the Armed Forces of the United States who is a resident of Oregon. In some cases, we have members of the Oregon Guard that are residents of other states.
Well, that was my worry.
I'm not so sure that the...
Whose home of record?
Yeah, I think membership is more important than actual residence in this case, because there still are members.
Okay, because we've already said a member of the Oregon National Guard. That is a very good
question. Let me ask you
this. Air Guard and National Guard.
Well, how about we? Now, we could.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry. I was just making. Sorry.
Representative Barnes, sure, I recognize you.
Thank you. Let me make sure I understand. A member of the National Guard is one category.
Oregon National Guard.
A member of the Oregon National Guard is one category. And then a member of the Reserves of the Armed Forces of the United States who is a resident of Oregon is another category.
I think
see what you're saying. I see how you
said that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think exactly. And I think,
so
if that's the intent,
we need to rewrite that sub A then in order to make that clear. Because it's quite possible to read sub A to mean an Oregon National Guard, a member of the Oregon National Guard who's a resident of Oregon,
right,
as in addition to a member of the Reserves of the United States who's a resident of Oregon.
That's how I read it.
And
perhaps,
how I read it, too.
Exactly. Perhaps maybe a term, Oregon National Guard, regardless of residence, or...
Yeah.
You know.
Thank you, Carl. I have a concern about sending it back for another amendment. Because I think the turnaround is such that we're not going to have an opportunity to get it to where we want it to go.
Follow up that, Madam Chair. I mean, my recommendation in concert with, and we sit on Revenue Committee, so we know what the schedule looks like, is that, I mean, if Representative Barnhart is of such a desire, that we move this, and then we will, Representative Comp and I will, of course, go to the Chair of Revenue and we'll amend it as we make our presentation there. Because my fear is twofold, is we won't get there fast enough.
Right.
And the second thing is that we must absolutely establish one of these funds somehow in order to get any money we're going to get put into it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, what I was going to recommend...
Would you...
My name is Matt McDonald, representing Honoring Veterans. What I was going to recommend is we use the same criteria as used for the Medal of Honor recipients that joined...
Excuse me, we're not listening.
That joined...
Start over, please, Mr. McDonald.
Use the same prerequisite as used to... that we use to recognize our Medal of Honor recipients. They must have joined the organization in the state of Oregon, which would, I think, cover both of them.
That's a very good point.
Also, there's a... In this bill, on line 11... I'd like to see deleted is deployed abroad because the reserves might be activated to take the place of others that are deployed abroad, and they may stay in the states.
It's already been deleted.
The amendment does that.
The amendment does that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, does the amendment take in consideration the $50,000 amount for the charitable checkoff if you're on the front page of the form?
No, that is not the case for all five, is it?
Well, if we go on a rotation basis, which I think the amendment does, that $50,000 requirement will no longer be in existence.
That's good.
So we don't need it in the bill.
That's good.
We've
recommended that they change this so that we don't have to have that $50,000.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We could eliminate that on the page 3.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, right. Line 14.
We have 18 organizations that are now under the Charitable Checkoff Commission. Of the 18 enlisted, five on the front page. And I'd be very happy if you went on a rotation basis, since I'm the chairman of Charitable Checkoff and have to answer questions. Why aren't we, or why can't we get on the front page?
That's right.
And I think by rotation is the fairest of all methods. Also on line 22 through 25 on page 2, we talk about the non-game wild, Alzheimer's, et cetera, in that section. I think someone should look at that section and see whether that that wording is necessary.
That's
in view of the amendment. I don't have the amendment in front of me, so I can't.
I think that's a good point, and I think we do need to.
Madam Chair, if I might interject here, we're talking about an amendment to a bill later on your agenda. Actually, it's the next bill that requires the Oregon Veterans Home account to be permanently listed on the individual tax form for the charitable contribution.
Okay, well, both.
That's the amendment that makes all of them rotating. And I think our intent was to send this off to revenue, where the I think that's within their jurisdiction is the decisions on the $50,000 and et cetera.
I don't think that their disposition. I think it's ours, and so I think I think it's a very good point, and I recommend we do that.
And I thank you for doing it. Makes my job easy.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, my suggestion, based on what Representative Oakley has represented about the Revenue Committee, is that we adopt the Dash 1s, send the bill off to the Revenue Committee with the discussion that we've had today about it, and get them to work on that, those other aspects of things.
I agree, and change it on the Senate side.
Well, or they can fix it in the Revenue Committee if they have a chance to do that.
Yeah, they've got so many to fix. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll need a fix just to fix them.
Well, in this case, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart's going to prepare the amendments for us.
For us, great.
And
then we'll just have
it.
I'm putting Comp and Boquist and Barnhart accountable for this.
We're already fixing
that
over there.
That was a slick maneuver, Representative Boquist.
Well, Representative Barnhart, Representative Comp and I are already fixing three of them over there. Okay.
We've learned from the best in revenue.
yes. Any other discussion?
I would just add that if you have the amendment on the next bill that does the rotation, you might include that in this one as well.
Okay, well, Representative Barnhart's going to worry about that.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
I'm going to close the work session on.
Well,
I thought we were going to do this other one first. Okay.
Whatever.
Madam Chair, are we going to vote on this one?
Well, committee, I was hoping we would read the other one first, and then I'll reopen this one so we know what needs to be included, if that's all right.
Yeah.
All right.
Are we on?
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2847.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2847 requires that the Oregon Veterans Home account be listed in the charitable checkoff program on individual tax returns. The dash one requires all entities eligible for charitable checkoff be rotated onto the individual tax return form. I believe you have a copy of the dash one amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have them out also? I have a couple extras if I need them. If anybody needs them. Okay, we're all set.
Line 7.
Representative Boquist, how is this DEERS program written? D-E-E-R-S?
Two E's, ma'am. D-E-E-R.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, is there any discussion regarding House Bill 2847?
Oh, boy. I have a question, if I may.
Okay.
Does this new Section 7 then replace the $50,000 requirement? Is that what that does, Jim?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I believe that it does not. I think it addresses the $1, $5, and $10 checkoff boxes.
Okay.
And deletes those.
Well, that, yeah, that's like the first part, but then it's Section 7.
But then it just adds that language.
That rotation language.
The rotation language. So, and I think that the...
It does not eliminate...
It does not get into the language on that 50,000.
No, it doesn't help.
No, that's still there, isn't it?
Yep.
Further, Madam Chair, it does not look like it eliminates... It doesn't eliminate the $1, $5, and $10 checkoff box.
If you go to page 2 of the amendment, line 9, it says, for each entity, the space for designated in the contribution, that is put in brackets.
Which means taking it out.
So I'm assuming that means take it out.
That's in Section 8. Section 6 will still be in place.
That's what I said. It doesn't, doesn't meet our purpose here.
Well,
so
it does take it out of Section 6.
How's it?
Line 3 and 4 of the amendment does that.
On page 2. Line 3 on page?
On page 1 of the amendment, lines 3 and 4, takes out page 3, line 37.
Got it.
So it does take out that language.
Good, I see it now.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take out the $50,000.
Correct.
So my recommendation is that we correct it before we move it.
Yeah. Madam Chair, may I make a different suggestion, if I can look at this quickly here? It's not going to work.
No.
Right.
So since we have to make this change, I think when we make this change, we can put it in both of them, and then you're home free. Because it's the same for the $50,000 portion.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may suggest, I think it would be useful to send the bills over to revenue. Mm. I will certainly undertake to prepare an amendment to accomplish that result, give it to the representatives, Boquist and Comp, and they can carry it there. I think from the standpoint of getting it considered in revenue, that's just as good as having it in the bill here, and it will save us a couple of days.
And I would concur with that. The backlog in legislative council and things we're seeing rolling out now are
giving us scheduling problems as the end is near, Madam Chair.
I personally feel that this needs to be corrected to the way we feel it should read now, because we have three bills that are dependent upon this. We have another one. The Wounded Soldier Fund is another one. Check off.
Chairman Nelson, how fast can you help prod legislative council on that?
Well, I would think that Dr. Stembridge, with his seniority, should have great persuasive powers.
We have a meeting Tuesday and a meeting Thursday. We could ask for the amendment back by Monday, ask them to cancel their weekend plans.
That's good.
Out of the building.
I vote for that.
We could bring it back Tuesday and then carry it over to Thursday if necessary.
Madam Chair, I mean, if Tuesday is Tuesday's it, but carry over to Thursday is going to start to get complex, Madam Chair.
We have 15 different measures from this agenda scheduled for Tuesday.
I just feel, I think we really need to look at this. Or we can put our complete trust in our new subcommittee of Colonel Boquist, of Representative Comp, and Vice Chair Barnhart. Okay. Let me just ask for a vote. I hate to move this dash one because it isn't right. Every time we do these things, it bothers me because I think someone thinks we're really stupid. You know, well, we move this, and you say, well, why? Well, to get in, you know, give it to a sub to go back and get it done right.
Well, Madam Chair, why don't we plan to do this on Tuesday, and in the interim, the good administrator can check with the administrator of revenue about if we do move these out, will they be fitted into revenue schedule?
Madam Chair, as you know, the staff works for the chair, so you might want to just check with the chair of the committee.
And Dr. Stembridge, we all know how much staff influences around here. I think the real question is the revenue committee staff would know what their schedule is, even more than us, to say, okay, when are you planning on closing down for sure, and what's the likelihood we're having?
If I could follow up on that, Madam Chair, one of the questions that I would have is revenue following the same schedule as the rest of the committees? It certainly did not last time. Mm-hmm. If it is this time, then we're under a huge bind.
Mm-hmm. Well, seeing that we've not heard a Senate bill yet.
Yeah.
That I recall in this committee, I know there are some coming that also will need to go to revenue.
Yes.
Is there any severe problem if we get the amendment? It's the same amendment, so they just have to write one amendment that would go in three different bills.
What's the third one?
The Wounded Soldier.
Oh.
Fund.
Tuesday's fine, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Howe. Thank you. I'll close the work session, and thank you very much for our doing that. I think it'll serve us well. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2862.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2862 directs public post-secondary education institutions to award credit for education and training obtained in the Armed Forces of the United States. You have two amendments. Let me know if you don't have copies.
I do not have copies. Anyone else?
The dash one specifies that the required awarding of credit is to be consistent with standards adopted by the Board of Education of the Community College District. The current bill says the State Board of Higher Education. The Second Amendment is similar, except it authorizes but does not require the awarding of credit. It specifies that credit is to be consistent with standards adopted by the Board of Education of the Community College District.
And Dr. Stembridge, could you tell me why we restricted it just to community colleges? Because I don't have that in my notes.
We were working with the community. Are you talking about as far as the authorizing? Because the amendments address is Section 2.
Right.
The community colleges were the entity that mm-hmm. was most concerned about requiring this as affected their accreditation. And that's why we have that language in there. They were also concerned about the language there you see in the original bill on lines 7 and 8 regarding the State Board of Education. The local boards are in charge of the decisions such as awarding of credit, and that's why the language is specified there. Community colleges were concerned that they wanted you to have the option to allow them to do it through the word may, or I think that's what the word is in the...
Okay, I got it. Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Now it covers all three, OHSU, all the universities, and the community colleges.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2862.
Thank you. Representative Bruin has moved the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2862. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Yes, Madam Chair. These are three parallel sections, 2, 3, and 5. The second one has to be fixed because it refers to the State Board of Education rather than the Board of the Community College District. So either Dash 1 or Dash 2 accomplishes that. Otherwise, I'm concerned about that we stop using parallel language in by changing shall to may. Here's my reasoning. In the second sentence of each of these sections, it says education and training for which credit may be given must meet the standards adopted by the appropriate mm-hmm. institution. I think that gives the community colleges, the state system of higher education, and OHSU plenty of wiggle room in the event that somebody applies for credit for something that they don't want to give credit for. If it doesn't meet their standards, they don't have to give credit for it. So I prefer to keep this parallel language in which we have in the other two sections by using the amendment in Dash 1 instead of the Dash 2. I'm sorry if that's convoluted, but that's maybe the best I can say it quickly. Otherwise, we've got a different provision for community colleges than we do for the other two. And I think there's a comment out here.
I do not see that conflict, Representative Bernhardt. How do you see that?
Well, if you look at line 5,
right. Okay.
The way in the original bill, the community college shall give credit for education.
And we changed it to may.
Right, in this amendment. Now, if you look at line
9. I see, and the others say shall.
The others say shall. Line 14,
yes.
Shall.
You're right.
I don't know
why we did that.
Well, I'm not sure that there's a real conflict between may and shall.
There is.
In the amendment, because the next line modifies, the next sentence modifies that. The education training for which credit may be given must meet the standards adopted by. So if the community college doesn't want to give credit for a certain kind of class, they simply adopt standards that don't allow it.
That's right. So we don't even need an amendment.
Well, we do need to amend the State Board of Education to the Community College Board District.
Right.
Which is Amendment 1.
which is, we could, you're right.
But we don't need two, I don't believe. Now, here's somebody here who disagrees with me.
I don't know if there's, if we can do this or not. I would request that, I know we're in a work session and not a public hearing, but I know there's a representative from the community colleges that would like to briefly speak on this if we would, if we give her that time. Yes. So I don't know if we have the ability to do that or not.
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, for the record, my name is Julie Sahonik. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association. We're actually dealing with two different issues, and that's why we're asking for the Dash 2 amendments. The first is right. It's not the appropriate authority of the State Board of Education to determine those rules, so changing that to local community college boards is that. The other thing is that as the bill is written, it says shall. And to us, that mandates the thing and impedes our local control, which each community college determines. It also says that we shall provide, that is an overriding term in terms of who the authority is. It says no matter who how the rules are set, by mandating that we do it, we have to provide education, or we have to provide the credit for education and training, and then the state board will look at how that is transferred in. And for some of our colleges, we do provide the we do provide credit for the education. Some of our colleges don't do it for training, and so this would be putting an unfunded mandate on us to start looking at some of these credits. We're open to it, and our colleges take the MAY very seriously. They take the language and the direction from the community, from the legislature, very seriously, and we will definitely be moving into that direction. And we're working with the American Council on Education, with the guidelines, which are nationwide, and with the smart transcripts that the military has been working with to move forward and make sure that, our soldiers and our veterans are getting what they need when they come back here and pursue their next steps. So we prefer the Dash 2s because of the mandate.
I'd like to ask a question, if I may. Thank you. Is there something wrong with my analysis of this material? I mean, it seems to me that if a community college did not believe that it should offer credit for training, they simply would include that fact in their standards that they're adopted under this bill, and then they wouldn't have to anymore. And let me ask it a different. Let me ask a different question.
Yeah.
Let me ask a slightly different question.
Okay.
Do you think that community colleges should not be required to give credit for education and training as defined in ORS 341.529 if they choose not to, even if the program would otherwise meet their requirements?
I believe that community colleges, we do give credit for education, but I believe it's how that should be decided should be left to the local community college boards.
Well, this statute does that.
Well, the way we read the statute is that the shall that we must do that mandate that supersedes whatever exists right now, and then that the local community college board would then set up the standards. But right now, this would force us to give training for education and training, and then the local community college boards would have to adopt the policies that they have that meets their local community college needs to meet that first part of the bill.
Well, that's not the way I read it. I'm sorry. I just simply disagree with you about that. Madam Chair,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to move to substitute the Dash 1s for the Dash 2s.
Excuse me. Reggie Barnhart, because we already have a motion. But what I'm concerned about is that if we say may give for the community colleges, Section 3 would need to say, Line 9 would need to say may give for the universities.
I think you have to realize.
Line 14 would need to say may give for the Oregon Health and Science University.
That's the problem I was raising earlier. Yes, ma'am.
Don't we have it?
And my point is, I don't think it's necessary because the next sentence in each of those clauses gives the university or the community college complete control over what they actually give credit for.
I concur with that. Did you have another comment?
Yeah, the one thing I would point out is that what this change does is recognize that we're not all governed in the same way. Community colleges are governed by 17 local community college boards. OUS is governed by a state board of higher education. We're not a state agency, and what this does is it recognizes the different governance structures that we have per unit, so I don't think that they need to be the same type of language.
Okay. Thank you. I think this gives you each district its same right, though, the way it's worded, where it says adopted by the Board of Education of the Community College District. So that gives each one its right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, we would disagree. We support the -2 amendments.
And why is that?
Because we believe that the first part supersedes the other part and that it still mandates us.
The first part supersedes.
The first sentence says you shall do this, and then the credit may be given must meet the standards adopted by the State Board of Education. They would be stopped by the local community college boards to meet those.
I see.
As right now, it's up to the individual community college board to provide those credits, which we already do. In fact, we already do this. We don't need to be in the bill at all.
Question, Madam Chair?
Yes,
sir. Have we had any information coming from OUS or Oregon University Systems? I don't want to have to pay too many dollars here. Or anybody from Oregon Health and Sciences on this bill? Because it deals with all three entities.
Madam Chair, not from OHSU, but we have had from the Oregon University System. They came and testified and talked about in similar fashion that they are awarding credit. They were not able to. They surveyed their members and their member institutions and got information that almost all of them are awarding credit, but each institution does it according to the particular application, how the particular application lines up with the American Council. I think it's American Council on Education that has the standards and has done the study that matches ordinary academics with military training and education. They were not able to do a thorough analysis of who's getting credit, who's not getting credit, how each institution does it, or whether or not each institution has particular standards that they use. Each institution said that they do award credit and that they do it with the guidelines provided by the American Council on Education, much as the community colleges did.
Representative Comp, I misunderstood your question. I thought you asked if we've gotten a written objection. Yes, no. David McDonald was here, and he's getting cooled on with 7 universities under his banner.
A follow-up, Madam Chair, as it's my understanding that this gets at the heart and core of a bigger problem in education that we're discussing here, that the reality is, I don't know if you've heard the scenario where a student at Chemeketa Community College is going to transfer to Western, and he thinks or she thinks that a certain course is going to transfer, and, well, Western won't take the credit, but PSU will. And so then the associations within the system have diverse explanations. So, therefore, if we, hamstring them a little bit with this bill, I don't know what that means. I mean, in this sense of what I don't know what it does to the bigger organization. And so I'm very hesitant to take any action on this bill at all.
Could I make an attempt? I don't think this bill deals with that issue at all.
Okay.
The reason I say that is because under -1 or -2, each community college board is responsible for adopting standards that determine which education and training credit is going to be given at that place.
Already.
Under this bill. So it doesn't deal with the issue you're raising, which is an issue of transferring from one place to another, because of course each higher education or the Board of Higher Education, State Board of Higher Education, is doing the same thing for the universities, and they might come up with different standards.
I think
what Representative Comp is saying, and I believe it's clear. is, regardless of the testimony from the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, what this rule does is directs the chancellor's office to establish rules to do this, and they do not now do that. They presently, they do it at each separate school, and this says right here, education training for which a credit may must meet the standards adopted by the State Board of Education. I think what Representative Compton is saying is exactly true, is we're directing the chancellor to establish statewide rules, and I'm not sure they even caught it in theirs.
When the individual was here, we can ask him to come back, David McDonald, as I write pretty good notes.
I do.
He said they will develop the OARs.
Correct.
So I'm assuming that there's a process that fits with this measure by which they were willing to work. But what would, if I could ask Representative Bruin to remove his motion this time, we will study this further and bring it back, if that would be okay with you. Yeah. And I'm sorry about this. I'm with you, but let's Julie and the community colleges know we're not moving today.
Then I would withdraw my -2 amendment.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2869 and adjourn this meeting with the rest of the bills being brought forth on next Tuesday.
Including the one for the
child. And the amendments. And may I ask if Scott, if you and Representative Barnhart would see if you can clarify House Bill 2862 should Representative Comp's advice.
I don't have advice. I have questions.
Universities very much, but we need them. But also, our military has substantial training, and I think that should mean a lot.
Who did you talk with? Who came to talk with us?
Billy McDonald.
David McDonald.
I mean, David McDonald.
Oh, okay.
Where'd I get
that? I made a mistake. I don't think they came and testified on this bill. This was in my negotiation discussions with them, and this is a committee bill.
See, my suspicion.
And in putting in the bill, we talked with them.
See, my suspicion is.
Oh, this is not.
Yeah.
He didn't come and.
My suspicion is that they when they got their rules.
Look it up.
My suspicion is that when they got their rules, they'll delegate that to the university.
I never heard of this.
And that's my guess.
I'll look it up.
Because the state board.
Know where I made up that name.
The state board is really beating up the chancellor.
Yes.
And they're not giving much authority to the chancellor.
We need to gavel, you think?
I did.
Oh, we don't need to worry about it.
I adjourned the meeting. I did. I said, well.
Representative, do you want to...